from the National Catholic Register. This is Register Radio, bringing light and clarity to the news and topics that affect your life.
This week on Register Radio, Jeanette DeMello discusses Pope Francis, marriage, family, divorce, and annulments with canon lawyer J.D. Flynn. Also on today's program, Dan Burke talks with Register writer Marge Fenelon about the impact of her recent visit to the Holy Land and why all Catholics should really consider a pilgrimage there at least once in their lives. Welcome again to Register Radio. It's a co-production of EWTN and the National Catholic Register. I'm Tom Price, along with Jeanette DeMello, Editor-in-Chief of the Register, and Dan Burke, Executive Director of the Register. Thanks for joining us. Our first guest, J.D. Flynn, serves as a canonical advisor and special assistant to Bishop James Conley in the Diocese of Lincoln. He previously served as Chancellor of the Archdiocese of Denver. J.D. serves as a canonical consultant to dioceses and religious communities. He also serves on the board of Endow and of the Cultural Enterprise Foundation. J.D.'s work has appeared in the National Catholic Register, First Things, National Review Online, and various canonical publications. He has a Juris Canonici Licentiate from the Catholic University of America and a master's degree in theology from Franciscan University of Steubenville. Today, J.D. and Jeanette DeMello will be talking about Pope Francis, marriage, family, divorce, and annulments.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm a huge fan of the National Catholic Register in print, online, on the radio. All the work that you guys are doing for the gospel is really incredible. So thanks for having me.
Well, J.D., you've contributed to the Register, and we really appreciate that. And
That was the part I meant was incredible.
Exactly. I was going to say, I have to point to your blog because you definitely just gave us a great plug. We need to plug your blog. So J.D. is blogging at the Register, and we're thankful for that. And the topic that you've blogged on most recently is Pope Francis, marriage, divorce, and the whole idea of the Pope changing some teaching on marriage. And the reason this came to be is that he is called a synod on marriage and family. That's going to take place in October of this year. The bishops are going to go to Rome and they're going to be discussing this topic. But ever since the synod was announced last fall, there's been controversy surrounding it. In fact, one headline I read said, "Vatican to debate teaching on divorce, birth control, and gay unions." But J.D., I don't think that's actually the purpose of the synod. Can you clarify for us what is the purpose of this synod that'll take place in October?
Sure. You know, the Holy Father announced this synod for the family to take place in October, really to take a look at the situation of the family in the world today. He put out a document in November kind of planning for the synod and letting everyone know that it was going to happen. At the beginning of that document, he says that the situation of the family today was unimaginable. Some years ago, he said, concerns which are commonplace today were unheard of until a few years ago. And he was talking about all kinds of things that we in the West think about, the impact of secularism and radical feminism on the family, the impact of pornography and ubiquitous divorce on the family, contraception, of course. But he was also talking about things that are happening in other parts of the world that we in the West don't think about very often. He says the great problem today of dowries, of the caste system, of a trend towards polygamy in some places. And then he talks about things that affect our part of the world and the third world, like the new move towards global surrogacy. We are living in a time when the family is being attacked on all sides by all kinds of problems, some of which seem so far removed from reality we can hardly conceive them. And the Holy Father says, now is the time for the bishops of the church, our shepherds, to sit down and say, how can we help families to grow in holiness together in the culture in which they're living? And how can we proclaim the family as a foreground for evangelization and for the transmission of the gospel? It's really an exciting thing because it's not just about what the rules are for families or what the rules are for communion or those things. It's really about finding a new way to talk about this basic block of human society, the family, and the model for the Holy Family as an antidote to some of the problems we're facing in our culture.
You know, we in the U.S. often think of our own particular problems related to marriage and family here, but we don't necessarily think of what's going on around the world related to marriage and family, and sometimes those challenges are different than ours. In fact, the Register just did an interview this week with Cardinal Maradiaga from Honduras, he said that in Honduras there's often pressure to marry, you know, a parent who actually uses violence to tell a man he has to marry his daughter if that woman has conceived a child out of wedlock. And, you know, that kind of force is not necessarily used here in the U.S., but he said that's a real concern for him, and that's not the kind of thing we think about. But this cardinal also said that the Pope's synod on the family is really the top priority is pastoral conversion.
That's right. You know, Jeanette, one of the things that the Holy Father has talked about most especially in Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the gospel, and in other places in his homilies, is the vocation of every Christian to be a missionary disciple, to be a close disciple of Jesus Christ, a friend of the Lord, and also to bring that friendship with Jesus Christ into the world and to bring other hearts and souls to Jesus Christ. And in some ways, the question for the Synod of the Family is, how can moms and dads and sons and daughters be missionary disciples together? How can they come to know Jesus Christ together? And then how can they bring the love of God into their relationships? You're a new mom, and you know
right. There's
nothing more important for parents than the health and happiness of their children. And what the Holy Father in some ways is saying is, how can we help parents to bring their children to the healthiest thing, the happiest thing, which is the holiness that comes from a relationship with Jesus Christ? It's beautiful to see him take this call of all of us to make disciples of all nations and to apply it to the relationships that are most close to us.
Why has there been such controversy over this synod? In fact, I mean, some have said it's like a storm that's brewing. It seems to be focused on divorce and remarriage, with church leaders seeming to take very different ideas of what should happen related to divorced and remarried people. What's going on here?
Yeah, I think it's no secret to your listeners that in some ways, since the time of the Second Vatican Council, there's been a lot of confusion in the church, and sometimes an effort to recast the teachings of the church, to move them away from the way that we've traditionally understood things to a way that is perceived as being more pastoral, but really in some ways buys into what Benedict XVI called the dictatorship of relativism.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that the church has been sort of trying to clarify, to understand the Second Vatican Council, the sacramental teachings of the council and of the church in a clear way, in a truthful way, and in a compelling way. Blessed John Henry Newman says that the water of a council runs the most clearly after it's had a little bit of time to get away from the source. He says maybe 50 years after a council we start to see things clearly. And we're 50 years after the Second Vatican Council, and we're starting to see clearly what the council taught. And one of the things that the council taught most clearly was the universal call to holiness, that each one of us is called to this extraordinary greatness as missionaries of disciple of Jesus Christ. Each one of us is called to be saints in our vocation. But there's confusion about this. And in the case of the Synod for the Family, I think some people have been uncomfortable with the challenges that the church poses, for example, to people who are divorced and remarried, to the call of chastity in their lives. And they've, in some ways, used the Synod for the Family to advance an agenda of this relativism instead of the greatness that the church calls us to. I don't think it's on the part of any ecclesial leaders malicious, but I do think there's been confusion about what exactly we're called to. The teachings of the Church on marriage are clear. Marriage is a lifelong partnership oriented to the procreation and education of children and the good of spouses. And that can't change. That comes to
right.
us in natural law, in revelation, and in Jesus Christ himself. And we know it's a sacrament because Christ made marriage a sacrament. Those things can't change. And so what the Synod will do is not debate these settled doctrinal questions, but say, how can we clearly and compellingly say that marriage is a form for holiness, using the Lumen Gentium's call to holiness for every Christian?
This is Jeanette DiMello on Register Radio. I'm speaking to J.D. Flynn, who is a canonical advisor and a special assistant to Bishop Conley in the Diocese of Lincoln. Now, J.D., you put this into context that this is about evangelization. You said that the church teaching is not going to change, but there's been this question over whether divorced and remarried people can receive communion. Why is there a debate over that? I mean, what is the position of divorced and remarried people? How is it that they could end up receiving communion again?
Sure. You know, the teaching of the church, of course, is that marriage is a permanent union. And so when a person gets married, they're presumed to be married for life. So if they get a divorce and then civilly remarry, the church says that we don't have any way of knowing whether that second marriage is valid or not. In fact, we presume the first marriage was valid. And so the church generally says that unless people have received a declaration of nullity or an annulment, which says that the first marriage was for some reason, you know, not a sacramental marriage, then a person isn't free to enter into another relationship, that we can't have, you know, marriage after marriage after marriage. And so a person who acts as if they're married when they're not is not free to approach communion. But the most important message about the Eucharist is that all of us are called to receive the Eucharist. All of us are called to communion with Jesus Christ through the sacrament of the Eucharist and to communion with the Church. And for divorced and remarried people, the Church says that means living in accord with their state in life, mm-hmm. in not living a life that resembles marriage when they don't in fact have a marriage, but living chastely and observing the teachings of the Church. There's been confusion about that, Janet, I think, because it's a hard teaching, and it's a teaching that has caused people, I think, a lot of heartache over the years.
Right.
And there's a laudable effort on the part of some people in the Church to say we need to respond to people's heartache and to people's difficulty. But I think the confusion comes in when we think that we respond to heartache with falsehood or by confusing things more instead of by saying what's true. And what's true is that marriage is presumed to be lifelong, and unless the Church affirms that a marriage is valid, we can't assume otherwise.
Right. And, you know, you wrote a great piece for the Register that talked about ways that the Church can reach out to the divorced and remarried people. And I think it's important that people realize that they are a part of the Church and that we need to encourage them to be a part of the Church in the most appropriate of ways.
And that's one of the things that the Holy Father has talked about. When the Holy Father says we need to find new ways to approach divorced and remarried people with pastoral care, he's not talking about changing the teaching of the Church. He's talking about finding ways to love people who are in difficult and heartbreaking situations. One statistic that I read recently said that the greatest portion of ex-Catholics in our country are people who were divorced and remarried and had a difficult marriage situation and didn't find anyone in the Church who would listen to them or help them or could understand them. We don't need to change what we believe in order to be compassionate, but we do need to be compassionate. We do need to go out into the world, into our own families, and invite people who are in difficult marriage situations to come back to the Church, to come to the Sacrament of Penance if they need to, and to experience the love of God. Because God is, in some ways, counting on us to bring pastoral care and to bring his love and mercy to the divorced and remarried.
Now, J.D., just recently, Pope Francis had something really wonderful to say to couples. I think they were gathered on June 2nd, which actually is my anniversary. They were gathered at the Vatican, and he had some wonderful advice for young married couples. What was that advice?
Well, first of all, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
Holy Father gathered with these young married people in Rome, told them that the key to happiness is to share the love of their marriage with children, to be open to children, to be open to life, to love in an enduring way their children instead of their pets. He said too often, and you see this if you travel in Italy or Europe or increasingly in the United States, couples who have so much love to give between themselves that they treat their pets like children, and they dress them up and they push them around in strollers. And the Holy Father said you'll be much happier if you're open to life, if you're opening to mirroring the Blessed Trinity in your family by being open to children. And I think that's great. I'm sure you found that with your own child. I found that with mine, that the love that we give to our children comes back to us 100-fold. And I think the Holy Father just wants people to know that children aren't something to be afraid of, but something that can bring the blessing of the domestic Church to their marriage.
Absolutely. I've felt the enrichment of my own marriage through Christian, my son, who's 4 months now, and it's been a huge blessing. J.D., thank you so much for being here with us today. It's a pleasure to talk to you. We'll talk to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot, Jeanette.
When we return, have you ever visited the Holy Land? Well, let me ask you this. Have you ever even considered it? If not, you'll want to stay tuned for some very special insights from writer Marge Fenelon. This is Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. More in a moment.
Dr. Ray Guarendi talks about the National Catholic Register.
The Register is catechetical news. In other words, it teaches the news from the perspective of the catechism. And you can learn all kinds of good things about the Church and faithful living through the Register. They cover a wide, wide range. Catechesis, explaining the faith, what's going on in the world, in the Vatican. Good, solid Catholic journalism. The Register helps people cut through the spin. There's no spin in the Register. It is faithful Catholic teaching, analyzing of the news from a Catholic perspective.
To start your subscription to the National Catholic Register today, go to EWTN.com and click on the banner for the Register or call 800-854-6316.
Let's return to Register Radio on EWTN.
And welcome back. Along with Jeanette DeMello and Dan Burke, I'm Tom Price. Our next guest, Marge Fenelon, is a Catholic wife, mother, author, columnist, and speaker. Marge is a frequent contributor to a number of Catholic publications and websites. She is a regular guest on Catholic Radio. Marge has written several books about Marian devotion and Catholic family life and has touched the hearts of audiences in a variety of venues. Her latest book is Imitating Mary, 10 Marian Virtues for the Modern Mom. Today, Marge is with us to talk with Dan about her recent trip to the Holy Land.
Marge, thanks for jumping on with us. Right after coming home from Israel, everybody's been following the Pope for a bit now. We're so hopeful about reunification of the East and the West. The Church can breathe fully in its unity. But we're not going to talk about the Pope's trip, but take a little bit more of a personal view of what it's like to make a pilgrimage to Israel.
Well, it was part pilgrimage, part working trip. And I wanted to do as much as I could to make this a real pilgrimage. And so what I did is, before the trip, I started soliciting petitions from my readers, from friends, relatives, family. Will you allow me to carry you on my back through the Holy Land? And I wrote all of these names in a little booklet. Yes, I'm working, but I also am here on pilgrimage, and I'm carrying with me all of these people who wish they could be here. And I did my best. It was hard to have very much contemplation when you're on the go. We tried to see everything in 10 days. That's huge. But I made sure that at each holy place I stopped and said, Lord, remember who's in my backpack. Please, this area of the world is the foundation of not only our faith, but the Orthodox, the Jewish faith. There was a very profound experience for me.
You know, I was able to go there in 2000 with my mother. She's a Jew, and I'm a convert from Judaism, though I'm not Jewish, but I'm a Hebrew Catholic, if you will. So the experience had a dual impact on me, if you will, very powerful. How did the overall trip affect your understanding of Scripture?
Well, we were asked, what is the one place you most love being at? And I had to answer, frankly, all of them, and I couldn't pick out one place. Why? Because standing, being in the Holy Land, for the first time in my life, all of the layers of my faith came together. And I'll do my best to describe to listeners what that's like. The Bible stories and all of the history there that goes way back to the Israelites and comes forward then again. And it was such a privilege, of course, we were there at the same time Pope Francis was. It was as if centuries upon centuries upon centuries suddenly collapsed into one moment for me. Okay, there was Jesus, oh, but also David. You know, all of these biblical heroes and all together.
I'm sure you visited the Church of the Holy Sepulchre.
Yes. It was, such a mix of things. Obviously, you know, when I reached to touch the Rock of Golgotha, I nearly could not get up. They got the tears rolling. I just didn't want to leave. And as I'm getting up and I'm thinking, the reality, we really need to preserve this place. And, you know, in years past, I would contribute to the Holy Land collection and think, yeah, okay, I'll give a little extra. No, but looking around the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I realize this place needs repair. The upkeep has to be astronomical in terms of financial resources. And I came back, and I was telling the folks at my parish, even if we never, ever go to the Holy Land, any one of us ever, we have to realize there was Christ, and there are the foundational points of our faith. We have to preserve this, or they'll be lost. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, all of these places, Church of the Nativity, the Annunciation, the Visitation, all of these places will crumble if we don't make a concerted effort to support these. And I was very surprised that it wasn't all spanky, wonderful, and perfect, which is what I very naively expected. No, because, you know, you've got some poor organizations, poor meaning, you know, they don't have limited resources, trying to keep these up. Without us, they can't do it.
My experience of the whole Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where Christ was crucified, was very powerful, as was yours, to see the rock and have the altar where you can reach in and you can touch that spot was absolutely extraordinary. What I struggled a little bit with was the hustle and bustle. I think I hit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre at a time when it was very, very busy. And so I asked the guide if I could come back when it was quiet. And so he said, yeah. He set up a time where we could come back very early in the morning when everything was just opening up. And so what I got to do in the cold of the morning, because it was February, was go in to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and I got to lay down on the floor on my back.
Wow.
Next to the slab where Christ was prepared for burial. And that gave me a chance to do something which can be hard on pilgrimage. And I really recommend people don't do that. I mean, if you can at all possible, just visit a few sites and go back. But I got to sit there and just try to take it all in, just to imagine what it must have been like. And of course, we have the most beautiful depiction of this, most powerful depiction in the Passion of the Christ. Now, did you have a chance to go see the area where the Dead Sea Scrolls were found?
Yes, we spent quite a number of hours in that area. And this community in which they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, and the depth of our faith and the finding of the scrolls, and the importance of piecing together the history of our faith.
Yeah, that area for me was critical, because as I was studying and exploring in my faith about whether or not I believe the Bible, the Dead Sea Scrolls, of course, were something that the Essene community assembled. And the Essenes were a Jewish community similar to our hermits. You know, they had left Jerusalem because they saw it as corrupt due to the political, you know, the government there at the time, and they thought that the Jews of that day were being corrupted by society, and so they went out into the desert, and of course they made copies of scriptures. And so what happened with me was, as I was studying toward my faith, is I learned about the Dead Sea Scrolls and how when they were discovered, they were approximately 500 years older than the scrolls that we had at the time, from archaeologists had it in their possession at the time. Now, when they compared those two scrolls, you would think there'd be a substantive difference. You hear people who argue against Christianity and the Bible's validity, and they talk about the telephone game, which is actually a very silly thing. According to that theory, there would be just a huge difference between what was recorded in the span of those 500 years. And actually, there's no substantive theological or doctrinal difference between that span of 500 years and what they discovered at the Essenes. So when I went on site there, I stood in the scriptorium where the Jews would copy the scrolls ritualistically. It was, if they made errors, they would destroy them. I mean, it was a very sacred thing. And what it told me, the way it affected me, was that the Bible, regardless of what it said, because I hadn't come to any conclusions about what it, you know, the import of what it said, it is a valid document in the sense of accurately representing what it is that the authors were conveying across time, whether it be the book of Isaiah, which was the Isaiah scroll is what was discovered there in a scene, or then later on to the New Testament, where we have over 250,000 fragments, none of which contradict one another, so that we can trust Scripture. And that's one of the things I walked away with in my visit, was the power of that experience in the scene. So tell me what was another big area for you? By the way, just as a break, this is Dan Burke with Register Radio. I'm talking with Marge Fenlon about her visit, pilgrimage to Israel, and why Catholics should go on pilgrimage. So Marge, tell me a bit about what was the next big stop for you that made a big impact on your faith.
The next big stop for me was the Church of St. Joseph, which is adjacent to the Church of the Annunciation. Beneath the Church of St. Joseph is an excavation which, depending upon what source, it, you know, could be the Holy Family's place of, you know, where they lived, maybe not. But regardless, that really surprised me because it is so completely stark. It just,
yeah,
so complete. I mean, it just, there's nothing. It's stone. It's all stone. And it's kind of dank and dark. And now, obviously, it was under excavation. But even so, because they lived, everything, they all of their dwellings, their buildings were basically of stone. They carved into the sides of hills. And it wasn't like we see in the kids' Bible storybooks, where there's this nice little hut that's built above ground with a door and a window. It's not like that at all. It's just a stone dwelling. And that it just took my breath away and just stopped me. And I thought, my goodness, I had no idea.
What about Mary and her role? You know, pious tradition, which I trust more than a cynical questioning of pious tradition, shows that reveals that a church was built within a reasonable time frame, just on every major site. But also, what were the key Marian sites there that were moving to you?
The Church of the Annunciation, the Grotto of the Annunciation, this tiny stone cave. And to think of her, however she was kneeling or sitting, or but basically our understanding is, tradition says she was in prayer, the angel Gabriel appeared, without, oh, and look at, I'm going to start crying. Without that, yes, Christianity would not exist, at least not as we know it. Without the yes that happened in that teeny little cave, we wouldn't have the Catholic Church as we know and love it. We have the Blessed Mother enthroned in our home, in our prayer corner. And I stood there, you know, with the tears rolling, and I said, you know, Blessed Mother, you visited my home, and now I have this tremendous grace of visiting yours. Mm. And that, for me, was just this, I could feel her presence there.
Well, and we have to go. We have to move along. Thank you for, Marge, helping us get a bit of a feel for the Holy Land. Outside of Rome, there's no more important place to visit for our faith, to strengthen our faith. And also, the Holy Land needs our support. A lot of people think that it's not safe. It's actually a very safe place. There's probably more places in the U.S. that are far more dangerous to be at any given time than in Jerusalem and the Holy Land. And they need our support financially. The Franciscans who keep upkeep the sites are not rolling in funds, and you can tell that by how poor condition many of these sites are in. So again, thank you, Marge, and thank you for helping us get a peek into what it's like to go on a Holy Land pilgrimage.
You are very welcome. My pleasure.
Don't forget, you can listen to our show again by going to ncregister.com. Look for that microphone to listen to or download the show. Thanks again for joining us this time on Register Radio. For our producer, Elena Rodriguez, Jeanette, Dan, and all of us at the Register and here at EWTN, I'm Tom Price. See you next week.
For more information about the National Catholic Register and about Register Radio, go to ncregister.com. Podcasts of Register Radio are posted on ncregister.com and on ewtn.com. Join us next week at this time for Register Radio on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.